The Guardian.
In the third day of our serialisation of Jonathan Powell's book, we concentrate on the 1998 Good Friday Agreement negotiations and on Peter Mandelson's time as Secretary of State for Northern Ireland. Jonathan, you have some extraordinary colourful details from the Good Friday Agreement negotiations, and you also solve the riddle of why it is Tony Blair said, "Today is not a day for sandbites, but I feel the hand of history on my shoulder." Do tell us about that.
That was one of Tony's most remarkable soundbites, and one of the least prepared as well. We flew over to Northern Ireland just before the Good Friday negotiations, to be honest, with no real game plan of how we were going to resolve the issue, simply with a determination to do so. And we went straight from the Air Force Base to Hillsborough and rolled straight in past the cameras. And we wanted to get down to negotiations with David Trimble, who was already there and waiting for us. So we didn't allow Tony the usual time he had to prepare himself before going before the cameras, and Alistair and I propelled him back out into the foyer of the building where the cameras were waiting. And he clearly hadn't really thought of what he was going to say and stumbled straight into the remarkable and a very appropriate saying, although slightly contradicting himself by saying it wasn't a time for soundbites and coming up with one of the best soundbites of his career.
And then from then you went down to the great castle buildings, which sounds very grand, but it's absolutely not grand at all. Tell us about that, where the negotiations took place.
Castle buildings must rank as one of the most unpleasant buildings to spend your time in anywhere that I've come across in the world. I've seen far nicer places and not anywhere half as bad as that in Afghanistan or in Iraq or anywhere else. It really was an extremely unpleasant building. And after it had been the centre of negotiations for many months, it really stunk of stale food and sweat. And when we were shown in there by Mo, it didn't feel like the sort of place you were going to make a historical leap forward. And we were confined to an office that had belonged to Tony Worthington, one of the junior ministers there, which looked over a blank courtyard. And we spent 3 days there, largely without sleep. And it really was not the most conducive place to bringing about a negotiation. And as we got increasingly tired, it became increasingly difficult to survive in the place. And I do remember John Holmes, a very distinguished diplomat now at the UN, at one stage getting so fed up with the whole thing, saying there's not going to be an agreement here, not going to be an agreement here, then lying down on a table and going fast asleep in his suit. And Alistair and Tony got increasingly hysterical as time went on, and they got more and more frustrated. And we found the subject of Ullants, which is the Scots-Irish dialect, not much spoken in Northern Ireland, the unionists insisted there must be a working body for to match the working body on Irish Gaelic. We found this particularly funny and found ourselves rolling around in laughter on that as well.
And you were saying that the only time and the only way you could get fresh air was to go into an inner courtyard, and you needed a security guard to let you in, and then you had to sort of walk round as if you were in a prison yard.
Yes, it was very reminiscent of being in prison. You couldn't go out of the front of the building because it was completely besieged by the world's press 24 hours a day. And there was nowhere else to get out apart from this inner courtyard. And it was all locked. There's no way you were supposed to get into it. Blank walls all round and a few windows higher up. So we did manage to get them to let us out there so we could get some fresh air during the course of this marathon negotiation.
And there was one moment of great drama, which was the agreement was pretty much there, not quite signed, but pretty much there. And the Ulster Unionist Party thought that there was not enough in there. It wasn't strong enough on decommissioning. So you managed to produce what was called a side letter, which I think indicated that if a party like Sinn Féin didn't use its influence to decommission, then you'd introduce legislation to exclude them from the power-sharing executive. Tell us about the drama of that moment.
Yes, I wouldn't like to take the credit for that at all. That was definitely Tony's credit, or not, as the case may be. We thought we had an agreement by sort of early morning on Good Friday, but it unwound rather dramatically when the various members of the UUP came in and met with David Trimble and made it clear to him they weren't going to sign up for an agreement because it didn't make clear what would happen on decommissioning and what would happen if decommissioning didn't happen and they found themselves in government with Sinn Féin. So a delegation led by David Trimble came up to see us in our offices in Castle Buildings and said there would be no agreement on this basis. We explained to them that we couldn't reopen the agreement now. It was being typed up. It was concluded. We'd lose everyone else if we had to reopen it. And they left and we thought about what to do. And Tony came up with the idea of a side letter giving an assurance to David Trimble that we would support him on this and that we would look very seriously at the matter if decommissioning didn't happen and they found themselves in government with Sinn Féin. We typed it up, or rather Tony dictated it to me, and I typed it up very quickly on a laptop, printed it out and neglected to save it or keep a copy, ran with it down the stairs because we were afraid the unionists were going to walk out of the negotiations at that stage, ran down the stairs, three flights of stairs, down to the ground floor where the unionists were, and then I found the door locked to their office because they were having a big debate about what they should do. I couldn't get in. Eventually, David Trimble says I slipped the letter underneath the door, but I don't think I did. I think I somehow attracted the attention of one of the young unionists near the door, who let me in, and Trimble took the letter from me and read it with John Taylor looking over his shoulder. And John Taylor said, yes, we can go with that. And then we knew we had an agreement.
And obviously you had the agreement. There was the signing ceremony, although not everyone signed up. Sinn Féin said, yes, OK, but we need a party conference. Then you begin your next chapter after the Good Friday Agreement description, saying actually the Good Friday Agreement was an agreement to disagree. And essentially what happened was that the agreement was based on constructive ambiguity. The sides could read into it what they wanted to. There did come a moment, didn't there, when constructive ambiguity had to end. The great harbour speech by Tony Blair.
Yes, again, this is familiar to people negotiating with similar conflicts around the world, that ambiguity is your friend when you want to reach an agreement. You have to bridge a gap between people who are unreconcilable. You have to find some way that they can both project onto an agreement what they want it to say. And we built that ambiguity into the Good Friday Agreement. I'm not sure quite how conscious we were, how ambiguous we'd been, and how long it would take us to unravel that ambiguity, because it then took 9 years to unravel the issue of decommissioning. But by the time we'd got to Stormont Gate and to Castlereagh, various IRA criminal incidents in 2003, it became clear, late 2002, early 2003, it became clear that the agreement really had lost credibility with people. It couldn't go on that basis. The ambiguity had now become an enemy to progress because it looked like the agreement stood for nothing. And that's where Tony decided to make a speech, which he made at the Belfast Harbour Commissioner's Office, saying that it was time for acts of completion, that we now had to drive the ambiguity out of the peace process, out of the agreement, and really end paramilitarism and the criminality that went with it. It was quite a high-risk strategy because at that stage you could have had the unionists walk out of the process. You could have had the Republicans walk out of the process. The unionists already effectively had, but you could have lost the Republicans for good then, and even then you could have had a return to violence, at least potentially. But it's a risk he took, and actually that was the beginning, I think, of getting into the last straight of the negotiations.
Now, a year and a half after the Good Friday Agreement in October 1999, Peter Mandelson was brought back to the Cabinet for the second time as Northern Ireland Secretary. You write in the book that you had high hopes for him as Northern Ireland Secretary, and that the instructions he was given was that because Mo Molum had been maybe a little over-sympathetic to the nationalist side, that he should perhaps court the unionist side. And you write in the book that Peter overdid that a bit.
Well, there was a classic Northern Ireland secretary trap that people could fall into from one side or the other. Mo had been remarkable. If it hadn't been for Mo and her completely different persona as a British politician, I mean, you couldn't think of someone more different from Paddy Mayhew or Peter Brook than Mo Molum. If we hadn't had Mo, I think it'd be very hard indeed to win over Republicans and Nationalists and convince them that somehow the British government was going to be different on this issue. The trouble was that as time went on, the unionists felt that she wasn't sympathetic to their side at all, and increasingly taking the sides of Republican Nationalists, and the ruder they were about her in public, not surprisingly, the more she recoiled from it. So she ended up in a situation where the unionists wouldn't talk to her, and that you simply couldn't conclude the process on that basis. So when Peter came in, Tony was very clear with him on the need to be sympathetic to the unionists and to be the person who seemed to be taking their case and listen to what they had to say. And Peter did that very well and actually was crucial in doing it at the beginning. If he hadn't been there to win over John Taylor and David Trimble at some of those difficult moments, we wouldn't have, again, been able to keep the process going with both sides still engaged. But as always with Northern Ireland secretaries in those circumstances, the other side becomes suspicious if you're friendly with one side. And Peter was increasingly undermined by the Sinn Féin and the SDLP to a certain extent.
And, I mean, you write in the book that there were pretty strong and serious disagreements with Peter Mandelson, who essentially said, you're giving too many concessions to the Republicans.
Yes, Peter's case was that we didn't need to make those concessions to Sinn Féin, that we could, in fact, have avoided their chiselling, as we described it, by standing firmer to them. He really took the line, I guess, that David Trimble takes, which is that such concessions weren't necessary. If we'd just been firm and waved the big stick, they would have come round. There's no way of never knowing for sure, but and we were simply guessing at what the bottom line of Republicans were. But we had no doubt that Adams and McGuinness were having trouble winning over the hardliners and the Republican movement, and it seemed to us not worth the risk of getting the agreement at the lowest possible cost. The main thing was to try and keep the agreement moving, to try and find a solution that they could buy into. And some of the things that we were dealing with, to be honest, were things that probably should happen anyway, dealing with the on-the-runs, as they're called, those prisoners who had escaped and wanted to come back. If you're releasing the prisoners who are in prison, why on earth would you not deal with those who'd run away?
But it's interesting because we think of Peter Mandelson as one of Tony Blair's closest political allies, indeed one of his closest political friends. And yet in the book you say that Tony Blair felt that he became quite pompous and was trying to appeal to the Prince of Wales Daily Telegraph approach.
Now, I mean, Peter is one of Tony's closest political friends and allies and is, as I say in the book, a remarkable politician and a much misunderstood one in my view. But no, we had our disagreements on those things and we got quite tense on both sides, although never quite as tense as the newspapers insisted on portraying it.
But the dogs were quite irritating. You give some stories of how he used to fly over on his special plane and the dogs would jump all over you and eat your sandwiches.
I hardly ever flew over on his plane, but I did fly over it two times, and the Northern Ireland officials used to get very upset about these dogs, and I saw them first hand because he wouldn't have them constrained in the plane. They did insist on them being completely free, and it was a tiny little plane anyway, and trying to eat your sandwiches was hopeless. They would gobble them up.
And obviously he didn't serve that long. January 2001, he had to resign over the Hinduja passport affair. And you write that he feels quite aggrieved by that and that perhaps Downing Street didn't treat him as fairly as he might expect to have been treated.
It's difficult. It's an interesting thing, having lived through so many of those crises in Downing Street, that one of the problems you run into is the immediacy of the media, the demands for answers now, mean that you can never really get to the bottom of the facts in the time that you're allowed to have them. One of my abiding memories of being in Downing Street is calls at 3 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon while in the playground with my young children, saying they want to know what happened 5 years ago on a Friday evening when someone said something to someone. And you're thinking, how am I going to find out before Sunday morning whether or not such was said? And yet people's political careers hang on that basis. It is a bit of a sickness of modern politics that I think someone needs to find a way of dealing with, and we didn't do so very successfully.
For more discussion and analysis, download Guardian Daily. That's The Guardian's news podcast, available first thing in the morning, Monday to Friday.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.